This is the Blaze Radio On Demand.
There's a threat on the horizon so deadly that experts warn it could wipe out 9 in 10 Americans. The Pentagon, a former director of the CIA, and the American Society of Civil Engineers are all sounding the alarm. But nobody in the mainstream media is listening. This event has the potential to cause economic collapse, mass pandemics, and the complete and total breakdown of the food supply all at once. I'm talking about our nation's vulnerable and crumbling power grid. Fox News warns our death toll would be staggering if the grid goes down. I want to tell you about a free video that has everything you need to know about this threat and how to protect yourself. Watch it now at blackoutvideo.com. Go to blackoutvideo.com and watch this controversial video right now. If you want to survive power failures and blackouts, you need to see this video. Go to blackoutvideo.com now.
Now, spreading freedom across the nation, this is 3, 2, 1.
The Buck Sexton Show.
Team Buck, welcome to another session in the Freedom Hut. Thank you so much for joining. The Broad Voice lines are open, 888-900-3393. Please give us a call. So we've already had a taste of, I guess, what we can expect for the rest of 2015 from the GOP. And that is one of two options. They sort of give you a very limited a la carte menu. You can sort of go with door number one or door number two. But it's all really the same because it's all not good. You can have a surrender or you can have lose, which I guess are the same thing. But one way or the other, they don't get their way. And the latest on this, of course, comes from the overtures being made by Mitch McConnell in the Senate to find some way, it seems, to fully fund DHS. Can't allow DHS to go without 10% of its employees for a few days until Democrats feel political pressure. Because, yes, they also are able to feel political pressure in certain circumstances. Can't just allow that to play out. No, no. Have to extend the olive branch. One side's going to cave. We know which side it's going to be. So you have surrendering. And then you just have losing, which I suppose is less to be blamed on them, but depends on how you want to view it. Depends on whether you're critical of the strategy or not, because they are trying to finally get Keystone approved and get it moving forward. And they passed it, and it has been vetoed. The White House, in a very sort of, this was a subtle veto. This was kind of like, well, we're not going to make a big deal out of this veto. We're just going to go with it. And the White House has decided that they would, and they have. President Obama has vetoed Keystone Pipeline's construction at this point in time. Now, there's so much about this that I think is worth talking about for a second. Let's just push aside our friends, the surrendering GOP, for just a moment. You have a delay here, a delay of 2,300 days. Since the Keystone application was filed, or they have to sort of get approved and then they can build it. And the Congress is saying, look, time to approve this thing, time to act on this thing, make a decision. And what the White House has been doing is saying, well, no, it needs more study. What's fascinating, of course, is that in the case of global warming slash climate change slash climate disruption, to say it needs more study is the equivalent of saying, I think there are some holes in evolution, or I don't know what President Obama believes when it comes to religion. It's the equivalent of completely discounting yourself. That doesn't require more study. Climate change is settled science, they tell you. But when it comes to Keystone, which is very measurable, and there are other pipelines around the world, then it's a straightforward proposition. Oh, no, that needs more study. That needs 2,300 days more study. This is an $8 billion project that has been cast into limbo. And we want to ask the question, why? And then try to answer for just a few minutes here. Keep in mind, they delayed this, and the White House delayed this, so that it would get around elections, of course, as well. You know, President Obama has been saying for some time, well, you know, if they pass it, I will veto it. But this has all been pushed off. And as we see time and again with this administration, they try to do things in such a way that the American people will at least forget about it in time for the elections, because there were some Democrats, particularly vulnerable Senate Democrats, who couldn't really come out against Keystone. In fact, some of them were pretending to be all about Keystone. Some of them all of a sudden found that they loved oil and drill, baby, drill and all the rest of it. And they're a bunch of liars. And they were changing their position because they don't want the American people to know the truth. Because the moment the American people actually see the truth of progressivism, which is the overriding ideology of the Democratic Party, they flee. They don't like it anymore. They don't want it. But Obama's rationale for this, as offered when he exercised his veto, which, yes, it is his presidential prerogative to do so. But on this issue, it's insane. It's crazy. And it is actually pandering to crazy people. That's what this is. There's no other rationale or justification. But here's what Obama offered up when he was wielded the veto pen on this, because it has been vetoed. There you go. And by the way, of course, the Congress, which is always accused of doing nothing, and we've heard so much about the obstructionism of the Republicans in Congress. They spent most of January working on this, and what we see now is, I guess that was all for naught, although they're saying that they're going to continue on. Eventually this will be, unless Democrats can maintain control of the White House in perpetuity, eventually this will pass. But why Obama wouldn't let it go through now is worthy of some attention, because it tells you a lot about the modern Democratic Party. He said that the presidential power to veto legislation is one I take seriously, but I also take seriously my responsibility to the American people. Well, what does that mean? And because this act of Congress conflicts with established executive branch procedures and cuts short consideration of issues that could bear on our national interest, including our security, safety, and environment, it has earned my veto. Oh, so it's a procedural issue, you see. 2,300 days is not enough time to consider this. It's a procedural issue. They don't even have the courage of their convictions to come out and say that we're not going to allow this thing because oil is bad and scary and I don't like it. That's all this comes down to. There's actually no other rationale. There's no other justification. It's oil is bad. Bad oil. That's the level of sophistication of the argument of the other side, because the tar sands oil that we're talking about here coming down from Canada and making its way to the Gulf, it's going to get pumped out one way or another. So there's no net effect on climate change. That's already been established. The oil's coming out of the ground. The Canadians are like, yeah, we're going to pump this oil. I think we're going to go ahead and do that. So the question is, do we want American energy infrastructure? Do we want to actually get revenue from this for government, but at the federal level, of course, for towns and the boost to economies for towns that are going to have the pipeline going through that will be paid rent, essentially, for the passage of this pipeline? Do we want that or what? What's the alternative here? Why does the Obama administration decide that they're going to be so very slow on this issue? Remember, he won't come out and say it's because of climate change. So if climate change is about saving the planet, they're not willing to make that argument openly. It's not important enough, apparently, to jeopardize the political power of some members of the Democratic Party. Saving the world is not more important than Democrats in vulnerable states not having to take an unpopular position or be tied to an administration that, in this case, is taking an unpopular position, right? This is the president saying, no, we can't do this. But he doesn't want to come out and say, I'm the president. I am the most recognizable and most important figure in the Democratic Party right now in this country. And I refuse to allow passage of this pipeline because I don't like it. Oh, doesn't want to come off as a petulant panderer to environmentalists. But that's exactly what's happening here. And if they were open about it, if they really told us why they wouldn't go forth with this, it would have downstream effects for the rest of the Democrats as well. Because there's no justification for this. It has been studied. It is fine. A pipeline is safer than other methods of getting oil in transit and into market. But of course, if you're going to talk about insane policy positions and insane decisions, you got to bring in Bernie Sanders, who says, and I quote, he decided to chime in on this issue,
"This veto tells the world that our nation takes seriously the crisis of global warming and that we will not support legislation that would let a Canadian oil company ship some of the dirtiest oil on the planet across the United States." Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders.
Oh, and then he continued on for a bit.
"Climate change is real. It is caused by human activity, and it is already causing devastating problems. Our job now is to aggressively transform our energy system away from fossil fuels into energy efficient and sustainable energy." End quote.
Bernie Sanders, socialist from Vermont, weighing in there. Now, the idea that they should aggressively transform energy away from fossil fuels is a sort of delicate way of saying, let's manipulate, in fact, let's dictate market norms, let's intrude upon energy markets to tell people that this is what it's going to cost for you. It could cost a lot less. You know, you could have very cheap oil, very cheap gas, or we could do it our way, in which case, forget about the fact that you need petroleum and petroleum products to create these alternative energy sources that people always talk about, right? Forget about the fact that, you know, you can't create even a windmill out of wind, my friends. You actually need stuff to build these things. You can't create wind turbines and solar panels without the industry that is supported by fossil fuels. You know, those big plants that turn out, these massive plants that turn out solar panels, for example, very energy intensive to create them, right? So once you start factoring that into this whole process, it doesn't look quite as clean as it did anyway. But Bernie Sanders is emblematic here of what you'd really have to call the crazy environmental left. And by no means am I the first to point this out, but somehow it hasn't seeped in enough to our consciousness that the crazy environmental left, they are completely detached from reality on this, and they are angry about it. They are vitriolic. They are vindictive. If they have to go after people to make examples of them, it's to save the planet. What wouldn't you do to save the planet? We've already heard talk about how your climate change denier, of course, directly intended to associate with Holocaust denial, because that's a moral equivalency that they like to make there. Think about that one for a second. People have piled on to PETA in the past for saying that killing millions in the death chambers is one thing, but killing billions of animals every year is another. That's a rough version of what PETA once said, and fortunately PETA got hammered for that one. But to somehow say that questioning climate change makes you like somebody that says the Holocaust never existed, oh, that's totally normal discourse. Yeah, that's fine. That's not something that should be raising alarm bells for any of us at all. No, they're completely insane. They are detached from reality. They think Al Gore is a scientist. They think that recycling is a sign of being a good person. They think we should all ride bicycles, while a lot of them, by the way, take private jets. This has become a state of derangement, and it shows you how powerful this environmentalist derangement is, that the White House will pander to them. There is no, even if you believe in climate change, even if you believe that climate change is a dire threat to the world, there is no difference that will be made by President Obama doing this, except oil bad, fossil fuel bad. That's all they have. Nothing else. Let's all solar panel good. That's all they have. They don't have some alternative version of events to offer you. They pretend to be pro-science, of course. There's nothing scientific about this willingness to stand in the way of infrastructure, which they say they care about, thousands and thousands of jobs, which they say they care about. In fact, safer for the environment than other methods of transferring this oil, which they pretend to care about. They are wrong on all counts. But the president is a political coward, and so he has vetoed this. The president's not willing to stand up and actually do what any rational person in this situation would do if it was about what's right. As we see with this White House, of course, it's about what's politically effective for them. That's all that they really particularly care about.
Taking intelligence to a whole new level. Buck Sexton.
The Blaze Radio Network.
Get your Team Buck t-shirt at theblaze.com.
Team Buck, I want to be very, very specific and clear about this. It's not just on Keystone that the Republicans are losing, and it's not just on DHS funding that it seems they're about to surrender. Also, on the issue of immigration, increasingly, the GOP seems to be losing its spine. Now, you will recall, many of you, that just before the midterm election, there was a real surge of the GOP saying they would do two things. No amnesty, repeal Obamacare. Very clear on this. This was something that they were hammering home in races across the country, and the midterms were a walloping for the Democrats, absolutely hammered them. So they've been given the power, and now we see what they're trying to do with it. Now we see that they are somehow ineffective, even when they have control of the House and the Senate, not willing to actually go to the mat on, certainly on the one issue, and they're getting some help from the courts. Obamacare is now up for review, at least the subsidies for it, but I will point out to you that those of us who are saying, well, if they take away the federal subsidies, that's going to gut the whole law. Unless states feel political pressure to get their share of the goodies going for people, states could start to fall. All of a sudden, some states are giving subsidies and others are not. Well, that may sound to some of you like, well, my state would never do that, but there are some states that will. Just because the federal subsidies can't go through a federally established exchange, it does not mean that other states won't say, well, my neighbor here, the state next door, is getting subsidies because they established an exchange as a state. So they're getting their cut. The federal government's giving them their goodies. It's not as simple as just, well, it all falls apart then. They have to have something waiting in the wings with which to replace it. But so they're getting help from the courts there. And there was this federal judge in Texas who came out and gave them at least some injunctive relief on the implementation of amnesty. Meanwhile, Republicans seem increasingly likely to just say, yeah, but I mean, is amnesty really going to be that big a deal? Is it really that much of a problem? Come on, guys. Let's be reasonable on this issue. And apparently reasonable means, yeah, let's have the violation of the rule of law on a massive scale. Let's just decide that identity politics trump the legal system. And also on top of that, we might as well just start sending people checks who haven't filed income taxes. If you're in this country and you're not filing income taxes, you are violating the law. But if you're in this country and you're not paying income taxes and you belong to a certain group in our identity politics world, well, then you should probably actually just get a check. Then when you're willing to file, you should just get a big bunch of goodies from the federal government. Obama knows what's happening here. He can start to see the cracks in the GOP. They believe the Democrat strategists and some of the GOP elitists who are out there saying, oh, you're going to lose Hispanics forever if you don't cave on this issue. They've been saying that for quite some time. What just happened in the last midterm election? Why don't Republicans listen to what seems to be the voice of the American people on this, which is we want an orderly and legal immigration system? It's very clear that the downward pressure on wages is something that really affects the middle class from the continued influx of illegals. And by the way, of course, now the larger the welfare state gets, the more it's possible to have businesses, particularly big businesses, that are sort of trying to push people off onto the taxpayer. So you're subsidizing all this. Whenever they talk about the free market aspects of this and shouldn't big labor be able to hire whoever they want? Well, no, because you're going to be subsidizing this. Your tax dollars are going to go to make up for the shortfall for the very low wages that some of these crony capitalists want to pay. Obama knows all this, and that's why he's going down to Florida, to Miami, this afternoon. He'll be doing a town hall. This is what Obama loves to do, by the way. Hey, everybody. Good to see you. You know, sometimes he gets the soaring oratory tone going, and other times he's down here. But he's going to have a speech. Hey, everybody. You know, and he's going to talk about how the Republicans are bad and they don't like minorities, and he's going to get lots of cheering from people. And this is what Obama really wants to do. He's like an actor who just needs to have people. He needs to be on stage and needs people to be applauding him, even when he's violating the law and the Constitution. A federal judge just said so, but doesn't matter. Doesn't care. He's on the campaign trail for this immigration thing because you know what they have realized? If they win on this, they win in 2016. That's just the numbers. Just count them up. So remember that while we're all supposed to be focusing on nonsense like what Bill O'Reilly may have said 30 years ago or not.
Buck Sexton, the Blaze Radio Network. Buck Sexton Show.
Oh, the parade of surrender continues on from the GOP. Net neutrality is the other one, by the way. I didn't even have time to get to that one. So we've got the veto. Well, they haven't surrendered on Keystone, and good for them for actually putting the bill forward. Let's give credit in a sense where it's due, although this shouldn't be hard. But they haven't found a way to get around the president's veto with that. Remember, there are ways. They could get Democrats to defect on this issue, and they should be able to do so. And at least in a just world, which we don't live in, I suppose, but also on immigration and now net neutrality as well. It looks like net neutrality is just going to go forward, having this FCC chairman who doesn't really want to tell the American people what they plan to do. And I watched the interview last night with Mark Cuban that on Glenn's show, and I've been saying what Mark is saying for a while. Unfortunately, I'm not an internet tycoon billionaire, but we see this the same way, which is that they're selling net neutrality. What they're giving you is heavy-handed government regulation. Just like what they're selling you is free health care with Obamacare, what they're giving you is government takeover for all intents and purposes of the health care system, you see? This is why people say net neutrality. It's like saying climate change. Well, what does that mean? It's not about net neutrality. It's about what they're trying to do and the powers they're giving themselves to achieve net neutrality. So these are all these issues. Where are Republicans on this? Who's making the case publicly? Who's standing up and saying we must not allow this? We must fight on this. The American people need to have their voices heard on this. I don't see anything. I don't see anybody. It wasn't long ago that we were hearing about all this, you know, all these fresh faces, all this new blood for the Republicans, you know, all these up and comers, these young Turks, these upstarts, you know, these conservatives that have come in. And okay, who's really capturing the attention and the hearts and minds of the American people on these issues and getting us rallied? What, Marco Rubio? I don't know what Rand Paul's been doing recently, but it's not working. Who? I mean, we can't just always expect to wait until Ted Cruz gets fired up. There have to be others. Who is standing on these issues? We hear from Boehner. We hear from McConnell. That's it. Nobody else can get any momentum for their ideas here. That stuff matters. That stuff matters. It has mattered since the forums of ancient Greece. If you can convince people that what you're saying is righteous, is true, is necessary, it matters. We need spokesmen for the cause. We need them inside of government as well as outside of government. I'm just not hearing anything. I am so unimpressed right now. I'm so unimpressed with the GOP across the board. And they should be making so much more of what they've been given than they have so far, I think. But they're going to cave. Cave, cave, cave. That's what they're good at. The broad voice is open. 888-900-3393. Let's take Catherine in Texas. Catherine, you're on the Buck Sexton Show. Thank you for calling. Do I have Catherine? I don't hear her. Hello?
Hello?
Yeah, hey, Catherine.
Hey, how are you?
You're on radio. How are you?
I'm good. So the reason I was calling, two reasons. So the oil's going to get here one way or the other, right? And it's either going to be by boat or train. And I watched a YouTube video, it was something like Town on Fire or something. And apparently the way that they're transporting it by train, they're using these old carriers that are not up to code. And they had a wreck in a small town and had this huge explosion and half the town burnt down. and it was like a really dramatic thing. So that's a better way to do it, right? Or by boat where it can, you know, go upshore and spill oil in the ocean, right? So it just frustrates me that these environmentalists think that this is, you know, not a better way. And then also,
well, there's just so much, you know, the environmentalist movement in this country is has gone even deeper than I think anybody really could have imagined into the land of make believe and crazy when it comes to what they're pushing for on this issue. There's what they're worried about there being a spill. Well, there can always be a spill. I mean, to be a mature person and discuss these things is to look at the benefits and the drawbacks. And they completely reject the benefits of this, and they absolutely overinflate the drawbacks. And because there are any drawbacks, we're supposed to say, well, we can't do this. It really just comes down to they have a almost like a bigot's hatred of fossil fuels. It's an irrational, deep-seated. They think that fossil fuel is a question of evil, not a question of something we have used to better the lives of billions and power the economies of the whole world. And, you know, they think of it as evil because it's going to destroy the planet. Once you understand that, you know, it's sort of, and thank you for calling in, Catherine. Once you understand the to environmentalists in America today, fracking and fossil fuels and the extraction processes and all of that, it's sort of like pink slime from Ghostbusters 2. Not a good movie, but, which is harsh because Ghostbusters 1, as we all know, is amazing. But the pink slime, it's just the meaner people are, the nastier. It's just, I don't know how to explain it. It's badness, right? And there's pink slime under the city of New York. I mean, it's the worst premise for a movie ever. But the point is that that's kind of the way they view fossil fuels. It's just badness. It's evil. It's destroying the planet. They think this. They're open about this. So if you think that this is destroying the planet, there is no length to which you will not go in order to stop it from being extracted, stop it from being used. And the only constraints on their insane ideas are that they're a very small minority. And most Americans like heating their homes in wintertime, being able to buy products cheaply that make their lives better and more comfortable at stores, being able to buy pharmaceuticals and all sorts of things that make your day-to-day more comfortable. They like that stuff. They're not about to give that up because hashtag polar bears are drowning or whatever. People look at me like I'm crazy on this, by the way. In my hometown here in Manhattan, I have friends. If you think you're a really cool, sophisticated, highly educated person, it is absolutely expected that you buy into this climate change crap, hook, line, and sinker. I look at them like, what is, there's not even two sides. What is wrong with you? You think it's normal? Find me another scientific discipline where over and over again you have scientists who are wrong, who are overstating the case, who are manipulating data, who are making stuff up. If they were doing research on heart disease medication, they would be in jail and their companies would be shut down. But because they're doing climate change research, it's like, oh, well, in that case, it's so necessary that they have to lie. That's what they say. You don't have to be a scientist to know this is crap. Just like you don't have to be a web engineer or one of these tech gurus. I don't even know what you call people who are really good at the interwebs because I don't know. You don't have to be one of them to know that the government taking over the internet is also a bad idea. Mimi in California, you're on the Buck Sexton Show. What's up, Mimi?
Hey, Buck. I wanted to give you another data point on pipeline, and that is that all of the oil is now being moved to Texas to the refineries, but it's being moved on Warren Buffett's trains, CSX. So that's another component of this. Warren is a big supporter of Obama. He's somebody who doesn't pay his taxes, but he wants all of us to pay more taxes. And so this is the crony capitalism piece of what's going on with the pipeline.
So I have to look into this. So there's actually a crony capitalist aspect of this as well, meaning that somebody who's as well connected as Buffett is. And look, he can get the president on the phone anytime, anywhere, whenever he wants. You think that that's factoring into this? Because, Mimi, I don't know this. I haven't seen that research, so I have to take your word for it that exists, or at least I have to defer my own judgment on it for now. But I can say that this is so irrational that I almost want to believe there's something else to it because it's so stupid and so crazy. And it's
yeah,
willing
I'll send
to
you,
it's
I'll send you.
Yeah, please do. Please send me whatever you have on it. I'll definitely.
And then one other thing, Glenn's coming out to Silicon Valley, and you've got a lot of Teen Buck people up here in Northern California. So I hope you'll come out with him and visit us.
I would love to. Thank you very much for raising it. I would love to come out and see you guys. I know there was an amazing, and I have not forgotten. I will post some of the photos. I wasn't there, but there was a Team Buck. Thanks for calling, Mimi. There was a Team Buck meetup down in Dallas, and that's just the coolest thing in the world. I mean, I see all these photos from the event, and people have made real friends from this community of patriots that we've created here, and I think it's great. So I'm hoping to get to one of these as soon as I can, and I might just have to sort of create one on the fly somewhere, and we can all just sort of meet up and hang out and talk and chat. I did get to see some Team Buck down on the after show last week, which was really fun, but I know there was also on the weekend a meetup at, I think it was Babe's Barbecue down in Dallas. I'm hoping to get there soon. So, 888-900-3393 is our number on the Broad Voice. And you can tweet at me at Buck Sexton. Send me messages on Facebook.com/Buck Sexton. Please, if you have not already, like the page. That's what I got for now. When we come back, I got some breaking news for you from the War on Terror, which is continuing on. If you're on hold right now, stay with me. We'll take your calls in hour two. Team Buck, got much more coming your way. Don't go anywhere.
Buck Sexton will be right back.
The Blaze Radio Network.
Get your Team Buck t-shirt at theblaze.com.
Team Buck, we have some breaking news for you. Three Brooklyn men have been arrested by the FBI for allegedly plotting to travel to Syria to join ISIS. And if they failed in that, they were planning to attack New York City itself in an act of self-radicalized lone wolf jihad. This is yet again another reminder of the threat that we face. Now, I haven't been able to get too deep into the details of this case, and they are still coming out. But what we know at this point, that three men, ages 19, 24, and 30, were planning to either join ISIS or commit a domestic act of terror. They say, the FBI officials say that this threat was aspirational and not operational, and apparently, they were found, as so often is the case, via intercepts of online communications of some kind. Now, I'm always very interested in this because generally when there's a terror case, now the threat is very real, and I want to be clear about that. The threat of it's also impossible to eradicate. So factor that into your calculations. We will never be completely free, not in your lifetime or mine. We will never be completely free of jihadists here at home. That's just not going to happen. But when they get into how they uncover these cells, don't lose sight of the fact that somehow there's always this sort of, oh, they say it's to protect sources and methods, but we don't get to know how it is they found these people. The most common way, as you see from a variety of these cases, the most common way is to have some kind of a sock puppet, a fake persona online, or someone who is an informant who engages them and then is able to find out the details of their plan, and then arrests are made based upon that. There have been some who have pointed out in the past that these informants have oftentimes a very strong incentive to really try to create or foment jihadist sentiment in these individuals who have at least radicalized. But remember, there's a step that goes between radicalization and jihadization. It's very hard to catch people in that one point of transfer. But when we find that they were tracked down online, of course, we have to start thinking, well, was this done using blanket surveillance of some kind? How did they find them? I think we'll hear more about that in the days ahead. So I have always, my first instinct is good. Want to make sure that we disrupt as many terrorist plots as we can. Not going to get them all, but every time we get one, that probably saved lives. But on top of that, you also have to wonder, well, does this continue to sort of justify the enormous counterterrorism bureaucracy that is getting larger and larger all the time? There aren't that many of these cases. I worked in the NYPD Intelligence Division, as I have told you many times before. This doesn't happen that often. And we have an infrastructure now that is absolutely omnipresent to deal with this specific threat. It can't deal with it completely. It can't deal with it in all cases. And we need to be aware of what the trade-offs may be by allowing this to continue to grow. All that said, radicalization happening at the behest of ISIS is something that we're going to have to continue to, I could say be vigilant, but that sounds like I'm some local politician who just wants something to say on the evening news. Make sure you maintain your vigilance in the face of threats. Okay, be vigilant. The chances of you having to deal with this directly or in person are pretty small. The government's going to be handling this in a vast majority of the cases. But I keep saying we're going to get hit. You know, everything we see happening right now in the Islamic State in those areas and across the broader Middle East, we generally see through the lens of, well, this is a growing problem. You know, this is something we need to be concerned about. This raises the threat level. The moment that you have one of these cells go operational on U.S. soil and kill a number of U.S. citizens, kill a number of people on U.S. soil, doesn't matter who they are, you're going to have a very different view of things in the Middle East. And you could see quickly, I think, how our sort of little bit by bit, piece by piece entry into that conflict will be ramped up very, very quickly. U.S. boots on the ground will follow an attack on the homeland, just as they always have in the past. Team Buck, got more coming up. Don't go anywhere.
Buck Sexton
on the Blaze Radio Network. Spreading freedom across the nation. This is
the Buck Sexton Show.
Team Buck, thank you so much for staying with me. 888-900-3393. 888-900-3393 is the Broad Voice line. Wide open. We're going to be taking some calls. I just wanted to point out that on the record, at least, Warren Buffett is for the Keystone Pipeline as of early 2014. He did say that it would take some business away from rails. So that's true. I was looking into this while we were in the break here. That Berkshire Hathaway has a rail subsidiary, BNSF, and it would take away some of his business if there was a pipeline. But he said, quote, "I would vote yes." This was on CNBC. But he has no idea, he said, if the president would approve it. And he says, "I don't believe in the Keystone Pipeline because of the jobs you'd make building it. You can build anything and create jobs. I just believe it's a useful pipeline." I got to say, I know he's a billionaire and everyone thinks he's a genius. That statement makes no sense, though. If it's a useful pipeline, well, then you want to create it and that creates jobs. So therefore, it's a good thing to do. Yes, you could create jobs by building a giant mound in the desert somewhere. But the point is, Keystone is a good thing for other reasons as well. And so why not allow the jobs to be created for building this good thing? Anyway, whatever. He's a billionaire. I'm worth like hundreds of dollars on paper, yo. It's amazing. All right, let's take some calls here. We have Bart in South Carolina. Bart, you're on the Buck Sexton Show. Good of you to call again. What's up?
Hey, Buck. I wouldn't be so sure that we would have boots on the ground if there was a terrorist attack in the United States while Obama was still president. I have a feeling he would bungle that somehow, and we would just end up surrendering all of our remaining credibility. But that's not really what I'm calling.
Can you hold for your second point for 1 second, Bart? I would just say the president did double down on sending more troops into Afghanistan. Now, there was already a troop presence there, so that is different. But let's just make sure that we're straightforward about the fact that there already are U.S. troops in Iraq. It's just a question of how many and what they're doing. So could he add to them? I'm not saying you're wrong. I don't know. But I'm just saying that I think we should keep that in mind. The president has been willing, when the politics were right for him, to put troops in harm's way. But go ahead, Bart. What's your second point?
Well, let me just follow up on the first point. And that is,
okay, sure.
He may end up sending more boots on the ground, but I don't think this will be sufficient to do the job right. Let's just keep it at that.
Fair enough. So what else you got?
The first point regarding what you said about the new left hating fossil fuels. Well, I have a little bit of information where this could be coming from. As you may know from my previous calls, we homeschool our kids. And as part of our homeschooling curriculum, we are essentially given a list of books to choose from for our kids to read on our various topics, history, science, and so forth. And you really wouldn't be surprised, but if you knew how many of those books are from a leftist perspective, even when you consider that a lot of these homeschooling curriculums have a Christian or even a conservative origin, I have to keep correcting my child all the time, saying, you know what, oil is not really that bad, or, you know, various other things like that, because those books are full of, you know, pro-polar bear, anti-evil oil corporations.
Bart, I see this in my own life with people. There is, among otherwise educated and sentient adults, there is an irrational hatred of fossil fuels. See, it's not enough to just convince people they all have to say climate change is bad, which is a nonsense statement, right? The climate changes every day. It's called weather. But on top of that, they've actually now created a situation where people think that it's now like, if you're a hard left environmentalist, oil is like nuclear waste. Oil is like a terrible virus. I mean, oil is an evil thing, actually. And we need to sort of exorcise society of this evil spirit known as fossil fuels. I know that sounds crazy, but I think you know from what you're saying to me, and I'm saying it, obviously, so I believe it, that's the level they take it to. They actually have this, it's like an irrational, it's a phobia. I mean, they're really fossil fuel-phobic.
Yeah, and they indoctrinate them young, you know. From documentaries that they are told to watch to books they're told to read, and the philosophy is definitely anti-capitalist, anti-industrialist, anti-modern Western civilization. It's all about fairness and all about animals and all about trees and stuff.
Yeah, there's a whole philosophy underpinning all this and sort of supporting it. But I think now at the tip of the spear really is hatred of fossil fuels. Well, Bart, at least your kids don't have to listen to that crap in school. So thank you for calling in, buddy.
Good to keep correcting them. Thanks. Bye.
Yeah, good to hear from you. Carbophobic, but carbophobic sounds like, oh my gosh, I'm not going to eat that pasta. It's got so many carbs in it. Like you're a left coast, west coast, life coach, pet therapist kind of Democrat. So we don't want that. Let's take carbophobic. I just don't want to eat the pasta. It's got so many carbs in it. And as was pointed out to me by some people, there apparently are some health benefits. So I can go on the record. There are some health benefits to whole grains, but people aren't eating whole grains. They're eating bleached white flour, and it's bad. That's bad. Let's take Richard in San Diego. Richard, you are on the Buck Sexton Show.
Hi, Buck. An aspect of this that's out there that you almost never hear about is what will happen if we don't have the Exxon pipeline. What will happen with that product that Canada does have? They are not going to give up on that product. We are not going to stop them from selling it. They're going to sell it to China. China wants it. And what we'll see is a caravan of Chinese tankers going in and picking this stuff up on the coast of British Columbia, which, as I understand it, that's some of the most treacherous seas in the world right there. And if we didn't like the Exxon Valdez, we're not going to like those spills every day. And, you know, you can say, well, it's up in British Columbia, what do we care? But the fact of the matter is the currents flow southward from there. So we might care if we see some oil coming down there to the coast of Washington, the coast of Oregon, and the coast of California. And this is never discussed, but, you know, people who say that they're doing this because they're worried about the environment and they're worried about the United States and so forth, why don't we hear about this? I've researched this on the Internet, and this is actually the case. This is what would happen. And then the other
I pointed out, that's why I keep saying it. There's no net effect, even if you believe in climate change as this evil, you know, destruction of the world scenario. The truth is that there's no net effect on climate change by vetoing Keystone. You're just essentially saying oil bad, no like oil. There's no rationale behind it because the oil is going to be extracted. It's going to make its way to market. It's going to be used. It's going to be sold. And that carbon does get up in the air one way or the other. So the question is, do you want benefits to the U.S. and also, of course, the energy security that you create by having, you know, the Keystone, by having it, having the terminal on U.S. soil? Do you want that, or do you want a situation where we get no benefit because of people being crazy? Basically, it's insane. There's no real justification for this. So I point that out, and I agree with you. But of course, the media and the press, they don't want to, because it just shows you how completely disconnected from reality these environmentalists are. But more importantly, it shows you what a bunch of pandering, intellectually dishonest slobs we have in the Democratic Party who will just do whatever they have to do in order to feed at the trough of these environmentalist donors, some of whom have very, very deep pockets. And as long as they can live in their giant Malibu mansion, they don't really care what happens to the rest of us. So I will keep raising this as much as I can. I thank you very much for calling. Hey, Cal, tell me who else we have on the line because the screen's gone down. Let's take Jonathan in Texas. Jonathan, you're on the Buck Sexton Show.
Hey, Buck, how are you doing?
Good, sir. How are you?
Good. I had just a little, kind of revelation I thought about today. How is it that the younger people, the younger populace, is more concerned about the deregulation of marijuana, but not the regulations on the internet? Both things that the younger populace absolutely loves and feeds off of, basically. Yet they're only interested in the regulations of the internet, but not pot. I mean, it's a weird sort of, mindset that they have regarding that. Because if you do believe that, you know, the government gets in the way of something you like and you want it out, wouldn't that mean that you wouldn't be for net neutrality?
I'm sorry, the last part of it, I kind of, you're saying, why do they care about marijuana regulation so much and not care about internet regulation so much? And what was your last point, though? I just missed that, Jonathan.
It was that they understand that when the government blocks or gets in the way of something or tries to regulate a certain thing, it makes it worse or makes it harder.
Okay. That's what I thought. All right, Jonathan, this goes back to what I was saying yesterday. And right around the same time, I know that Rush was addressing this as well on air, which was kind of funny, about how Obamacare and net neutrality have been sold in the same way, which is that you get people to rally around, and you can take this down to sort of the level of Saul Alinsky. And Alinsky says in Rules for Radicals, once you organize people around something as commonly agreed upon as pollution, then an organized people is on the move. From there, it's a short and natural step to political pollution, to Pentagon pollution, et cetera, et cetera. With Obamacare, they sold people on health care for everyone. And that was what got sort of jammed into people's brains, at least those who are susceptible to these kinds of lies from the government. And everything after that was irrelevant because it was about health care for everyone. And that's how they were able to at least convince them. Or they never convinced the right in America. They never convinced Republicans to go along with this, and they never got a Republican vote. But with net neutrality, it's been really the same gambit in that they've convinced people net neutrality is a good thing. Net neutrality is a good thing. And everyone goes, okay, yeah, net neutrality, which is supposed to be, by the way, the net's supposed to be the way it is and has been. And so they say, well, net neutrality is a good thing. So we need to stop the ISPs from violating net neutrality. And so we need more regulatory authority to stop that. And then what they did is net neutrality is a good thing. Net neutrality is a good thing. Oh, by the way, we're going to have control to regulate everything on the internet. Prices, speeds, competition, licensing, everything is going to be now in the hands of the government once this FCC regulation is passed. But it's because they sold it with net neutrality essentially is a Trojan horse, right? It's, oh, okay, yeah, net neutrality is good. And so when you try to criticize it, young people go, oh, no, no, no. Obama says he's for net neutrality. The Obama version of net neutrality is like the Obama version of free health care. It's a lie, it's crap, and it's going to have all sorts of unintended consequences, as well as intended consequences that they lie to you about. Do you know what I'm saying? Is that clear?
Yeah, yeah.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, it makes sense. Yeah, it makes sense. It just shows how idiotic, I guess, the younger people are. I mean, if they can't...
Yeah, I don't know what to say about young people. You know,
At least I'm one of... I know only a few of the Team Buck members who are the good young people.
Yeah, no, I know. As a sort of self-proclaimed Gandalf the Grey of the millennials, I don't know what to say. I want to usher along all the hobbits in their early 20s and bring them to the beautiful uplands of freedom and prosperity. But a lot of them, you know, they buy into this. That's why when people say, oh, I don't. And thanks, Jonathan, by the way, for calling in. It's always good to hear from you, buddy. And keep the shield high down there in Texas. You know, that's why when people say, oh, you don't watch the Oscars. No, I need to see. Well, look, first of all, some of it I just find entertaining. But I'm not going to lie about that. But also, you want to see how the propaganda gets out there, because this is what, you know, they rely on. Obama relied on huge turnout from young people who are otherwise disinterested in or disaffected by politics. And that's all from the culture. That's a cultural phenomenon. That's people thinking he's cool and the Democrats are cool. I mean, that the Democrat Party, which has Nancy Pelosi, Harry Reid, Hillary Clinton. I mean, when you look at the people that are actually at the forefront of the Democratic Party, to think that Democrats are cool is one of the greatest lies that any group of people has ever pulled off in history. There was nothing cool about these people. I mean, you put up their standard bearers, absent Barack Obama, who is, for a number of reasons that have been endlessly discussed, kind of an anomaly for the Democrats. And, you know, there was the whole thing of being the first in a variety of ways for this president. But when you look at the rest of the Democrats, these are like the least cool people on earth. They are the least charming. They are the least honest. They're the least inspiring. And that somehow people who are in their 20s are like, yeah, man, I'm all about. But it gets down to some of the issues. And everyone's been convinced on the young people, I mean, on climate change. And they've been convinced on, abortion on demand up to and including the moment of not the moment of conception, but the moment of birth. So that somehow has all just gotten tied in together, and it's our job to untangle this morass and try to find some truth and try to win some converts to our side. I'm looking for converts here, not heretics. All right, Team Buck, 888-900-3393, back in a minute.
This is the Buck Sexton Show.
The Blaze Radio Network.
You're listening to Buck Sexton.
As I'm sure many of you have already read or have heard, in the trial of the murder of Chris Kyle, Navy SEAL, and of course the American sniper, Eddie Ray Ruth has been found guilty of capital murder. And this is one of those moments where you take a step back and you think, I know that this is what the justice system can do in this circumstance. Maybe they could have gone for a death penalty conviction, although given the psychiatric state of this individual, that may have been tougher for a jury, and they might have wanted to go with a lesser sentence of life in prison without parole. And I know that I was seeing the reactions last night and thinking to myself, there is, as much as we call it the justice system, to have lost a hero like this in this manner, not only does it feel particularly just wrong and painful that he risks so much on the field of battle, comes home to be with his wife and family and his country, and then is serving, even here at home, his fellow Americans, and that is what results in his death. That just feels even more wrong and brutal under the circumstances than anyone could have ever imagined, right? That he would be through so much overseas. He would go through so much overseas and then make it back here and then trying to help others who are in a difficult place and then to be murdered in cold blood. There just is no justice for that. And I think that's a tough thing for us all to have to accept. This is the closest thing that our system can give us to justice. But with the loss of someone like Chris Kyle, he cannot be replaced. He certainly cannot be ever replaced in the eyes of his family who love him. And so you're just left to think, what a horrific day and a horrific tragedy. And I know justice was served as a matter of law, but there is no justice when you have a loss like this, because nothing can ever bring Chris Kyle back. I do think, though, that also this whole period where we see the popularity and the phenomenon of American Sniper as a film, it's interesting to me that there are so many who have been unable on the left to understand what is it that appeals so much about this to the American people. And of course, you have the wanton and unfair and crazed accusations of warmongering on the right. And you've had some pretty insane things said about why this movie appeals to the American people. And the truth of it is that as a country, we just appreciate having a moment to look at service and bravery and courage for what it is, and to actually be allowed to see it as such, absent the politics of WMDs, the politics of war, men and women in uniform, what they go through, the sacrifices they make, and the courage and service that they display. That's, for many of us, refreshing. And that's something that I think finally we were able to, as a country, take a real moment to appreciate, and Chris Kyle really exemplified that. And in that sense, Chris will live forever.
You're listening to Buck Sexton, only on the Blaze Radio Network.
What team are you on? Get your Team Buck shirt now at theblaze.com.
There's a piece in the Wall Street Journal sometime in the last couple of days. It raised a very interesting issue, I think. It was by Seth Cropsey, who is a director of the Hudson Institute's Center for American Sea Power. He's a former naval officer and deputy undersecretary of the Navy for Ronald Reagan and George H.W. Bush. So the guy's a Navy guy, and he's talking about the threat to the Mediterranean that ISIS poses if it continues to consolidate and solidify its hold in Libya. Now, this is interesting because of some historical parallels that immediately come to mind for me with what we saw with the Barbary Wars. Now, of course, there are some very distinct differences and a couple of hundred years separating these things. But nonetheless, Libya is a quick shot to Italy, particularly to Sicily. And you have already with Somalia the establishment of a sort of pirate kingdom and what that's done to shipping there. And of course, there was that movie about the Maersk Alabama, and I forget what the movie's called. Cal, what's that movie with the SEAL shooting Captain Phillips, right? Yes, Captain. I haven't seen it, actually. I should probably see it. But Captain Phillips about Somali pirates and that situation. Well, you could pretty easily foresee something along those lines off the coast of Libya. And if the Libyan government isn't able, whatever. And I say that as I say it, I think to myself, what is a Libyan government exactly? Who really knows at this point? Is there really a Libyan government? It's kind of an open question. But if you have the establishment of a jihadist kingdom on the Mediterranean, sort of Mogadishu on the Mediterranean, which I'm now seeing popping up in other people's analysis. And I was talking about this on Real News, a year, maybe 18 months ago. I'm just saying. So I should have trademarked it, a la Stephen Colbert, trademark Mogadishu on the Mediterranean. But if you have that kind of a situation, we may be in a less robust, I guess that's sort of a policymaker word, a less robust position to try and combat that threat than we may think. For example, as this piece points out, in the Cold War era, the U.S. 6th Fleet, which is the Mediterranean Naval Force, had two aircraft carriers, an amphibious ready group, and escorting vessels. And today, all it has is a command ship based in Italy and a couple of destroyers armed with guided missiles in Spain. So we don't have the force presence in the Mediterranean to immediately deal with a threat, a sort of jihad by sea threat from the Islamic State. Remember, this is now access, this is now open access to the Mediterranean. And as much territory as ISIS has been able to seize, as much territory as ISIS has been able to seize in Syria, they have not been able to, they have not been able at this point to get direct access to the sea and to get a port. If they have Sirte in Libya, if they're able to get that town or so, that city under their full control, they will have a port on the Mediterranean, close shot to the Europeans. And we don't really have much of a permanent naval presence in the Mediterranean to deal with this. Now, we could up it pretty quickly. And usually what people say is, well, there's so many fleets going into and out of the Gulf region that what you rely on is, well, there'll be a fleet coming through here soon. So if we needed them, we would just call upon the fleet as it crosses the Mediterranean from other missions. But that's something that I think we may not want to necessarily be reliant on. But in a broader sense as well, you have a situation where we might be drawn into conflict in North Africa. And we've already been there, of course. Remember, leading from behind, getting rid of Gaddafi, that whole thing. But we could be drawn into a conflict in North Africa again because of attacks on shipping or terrorist acts on the high seas. And just immediately brings back a historical parallel for people like me who are fascinated by the Barbary Wars and also find it very interesting that they are so not studied in school. Let's just put it that way. And that the president would stand up and tout, for example, our friendship with Morocco in his speech in Cairo in 2009. I guess nobody thought, nobody was in a position, or he didn't think they'd be in a position to really challenge the fact that those Islamic kingdoms, those emirates on the coast of North Africa from the start of the American Republic, they were not our buds. We were not friends. In fact, those kingdoms had engaged in centuries of a massive campaign of piracy and slavery. That was the main impetus behind the piracy. Understand that. It's not that they were just trying to seize goods on the high seas. The goods were people. And they were grabbing Europeans and they were grabbing Americans, too, later on. And there was a time when Algiers was an incredibly wealthy city because it had been so successful in the slave trade. And yes, this was primarily white slavery. This was seizing white Europeans on the high seas, and then they were slaves just like slaves in other countries for centuries, for millennia past. They were human property. And Algiers became a very wealthy kingdom for a period of time because of that. Now, I'm not suggesting that ISIS is going to be seizing slaves by the thousands on the high seas. Well, if you go back in history, though, for example, Hayrettin Barbarossa, we talked about a bit during the Lepanto show, these were boogeymen for Europe. All throughout the 15th to 16th century, the pirates of the Mediterranean, who were North African Muslim corsairs, they were sailing corsairs, they would seize whole villages along the coasts of Spain and the various islands off the coasts of Italy, the Italian mainland. They would just seize people. They would come ashore and grab all the women and children, kill all the men who resisted, and take them into slavery. Now, that's not going to happen with ISIS per se, although, as you know, ISIS is engaged in slavery in Iraq and Syria. They are grabbing slaves there, most notably Christians and Yazidis in the case of the Iraq-Syria front. But I do think we have to take very seriously the notion of having a threat in a Libyan city that could engage in jihadist attacks. And see, this is the problem. This is the problem with them seizing territory instead of trying to engage in terrorism that redirects U.S. policy. Once they've seized territory, airstrikes aren't really enough anymore. Because even if you can prevent a massed army from forming for the purposes of invasion or further conquest, which is more or less what we've been able to do in Iraq and Syria. If you want to get people out of a city, if you want to chase the bad guys out of a town, we've seen how you have to do that. And the model for this, or you know, the historical parallel for this, is Fallujah, is Ramadi, some of those cities that play are front and center in American Sniper, for example. That's what you have to do. You've got to send in people who go door to door, go house to house, and they root out the bad guys. So if you have a sort of jihad by the sea situation with any city in Libya, but they've already started to get closer and closer to that because of the command and control structure of ISIS seems to be getting stronger in Libya, then we're going to have to deal with this threat in some capacity, and we will be in a sort of 21st century Barbary war, because it will be jihadists once again on the coast of Africa drawing us into some kind of conflict. And as much as we would think, well, we have the Navy to deal with this, and we certainly do, and we have the airstrikes that we could, air power that we could use, we certainly do. If you really want to root them out, we're going to face the same problems that were faced by Jefferson and Adams, which is that you can fight back on the sea, but eventually you have to take the fight into their own hometown. And we may be in a position where that happens. And I'm telling you, we are one incident, and I can't foresee what it is, whether it's an attack on the homeland or an attack on our interests abroad. We're one incident away from everyone's sense of this threat from the Islamic State changing very dramatically. Remember, I was telling you back in August that there will be U.S. troops deployed in forward combat roles in some capacity in Iraq, and now we've got the new authorization. They're talking about taking Mosul, and that is going to happen. But I also think, and it might be on a slightly longer timeline than that, you're going to see something that changes our calculations about involvement against this. And if it involves Libya, and it looks more and more like it might, this will be a sort of 21st century Barbary war. 888-900-3393. Team Buck, some more thoughts on some fun stuff or some interesting stuff or some serious stuff. I haven't yet figured it out. In just a minute.
Let your voice be heard.
Hello.
888-900-3393.
Buck Sexton Show.
On the Blaze Radio Network.
This is the Buck Sexton Show.
Team Buck, you know, we talk about what's happening with the Islamic State, and there's, of course, this continued effort to separate all of that out from, you know, mainstream Islam in any capacity. It's not actually a part of the religion, and we've had the president, I think, just objectively speaking, he's just been embarrassing himself on this issue for weeks now, but it shows you the depth of his desire to weighed in as some kind of a theologian who defends Islam at every point and every opportunity. But you see now the Saudis, our allies, quote unquote, the Saudis, have given the death penalty to a man who renounced his Muslim faith. Now, this has a particular resonance. This is a particularly important point, because it is often said that, well, extreme belief is not actually a part of Islam, religion of peace, all that stuff. And then those of us who've spent more time thinking about this, studying this around Islam in some capacity or another, will say, but no, there are some beliefs that are actually mainstream that we would consider extremist, but that within the Islamic community are not considered extremist. Or if they're considered to be a minority position, it's a very healthy minority, a very large minority, as minorities go, that believe this. And death for apostasy is one of them. You really can't find a whole lot of respected clerics. And I don't mean clerics that are essentially, trained poodles for some regime somewhere who do what they're told. But you cannot find respected Muslim clerics who will say that apostasy is not a grave sin for which there must be a very severe punishment. Apostasy just means leaving the religion. So you now have a Saudi Arabian court that has sentenced a man to death because he made a video of himself tearing up the Quran. So he destroyed an inanimate object, a book, and they want to kill him now. This comes after, of course, blogger Raif Badawi was sentenced to 1,000 lashes just for criticizing the country's religious establishment. So for criticizing the imams, he gets 1,000 lashes. So there is no freedom worthy of the name in Saudi Arabia. It is a totalitarian state. And this is a country with which we have found ourselves for various reasons. Understandable, though perhaps not morally justifiable. We found ourselves allied with them. And so this is the heartland of Islam. This is an Islamic regime. And it is the premier Sunni Arab power, really, now in the whole Middle East. And they kill people for destroying a book. They will do that. And that is their law. So to say that that's outside the mainstream, well, someone explained to me how it is that the country that is most associated with Islam, that is the site of the two holiest cities in Islam, Mecca and Medina. Third is Jerusalem, of course, even though Muhammad never made it to Jerusalem. A side point on that, by the way, I've noticed I get a fair amount of emails from some of you saying, why do you refer to him as the Prophet Muhammad? That you find that grating in some capacity, or though like it's some honorific title. Well, it's just because when in the course of studying this, as you know, Muhammad is a very common name. And so to just say Muhammad, people get the habit of saying, no, the specific Muhammad that was the founder of this faith, as opposed to any number of other Muhammads, including his immediate descendants or his direct line, his lineage. That's why people say it. I mean, if you really wanted to be honorific, you would always say the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him. So if you want to know, if you're trying to be particularly respectful or to sort of bend the knee, depending on how you want to put it, I would always say, well, the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him. And that's a different thing. Because I know I've said, some of you have written to me, you said, well, why not just always say Jesus Christ, our Lord and Savior? And I say, well, one, it's kind of long. But also, when you refer to Jesus, because in the West, I know people say Jesus, but generally speaking, there's only one Jesus. There's a lot of Muhammads. It's the most common name for boys, as I understand it, in the UK, although I think some people have debated that. But there's a lot of Muhammads, is the point. So that's why you say the Prophet Muhammad. It's just as a means of designating exactly who you're talking about, so there's no confusion. All right. Nonetheless, Saudi Arabia says they're going to give the death penalty to this guy. What's interesting is that you can even take it then a further. So you've got ISIS, extreme, bad, but totally rejected by the Islamic community. Okay. Well, what about Saudi Arabia? Okay. Some extreme things and bad, but not representative of the Sunni Muslim community, even though it is the regime that is where the holy cities are and it's the birthplace of Islam. And Saudi Arabia is to Islam what Rome and the Vatican and Italy are to Catholicism. So it's kind of hard to totally separate these things out, but they try. What about in a Western society? There's a poll that was conducted, and it's getting a fair amount of attention. And this was via the British paper, The Telegraph. It says that for those of us who want to be constantly comforted by the notion that these are fringe beliefs, things like death for apostasy or fringe beliefs or Sharia law or fringe beliefs, I know many of you don't believe that, but if you think that that's comforting, let me just share with you some of what this survey found among Muslims in the UK. 40% of Muslims surveyed in the UK believe in the introduction of Sharia into British law for Muslims. A third of them back the notion of a worldwide Islamic caliphate for which the only law will be Sharia. 40% feel it is unacceptable for men and women to mix in society. And there's even some statistics on support for ISIS. I'm not going to get through all these stats today, but let me just say that 32% of Muslims said that killing in the name of religion was justified. These are frightening statistics, my friend. We'll have to do a buck brief tomorrow with all of this stuff and dig into it a bit more. I know it went a little late today. Shields high, everybody. Back tomorrow.
The Buck Sexton Show on the Blaze Radio Network.